Hello, everyone. This is Jeff Chiro, and I'm with the Central New York Regional Center for Tobacco Health Systems at St. Joe's Hospital Health Center. And I'm actually going to take the call this morning, a little unprepared. However, we were waiting for our manager, so we don't want to delay this call or this webinar. So we have Kim Riche on the line. So please, Kim, hopefully everyone can hear you. Please take it away.
Sure, thanks. So I am a psychologist at the University of Kansas Medical Center, and I do research on smoking cessation among people in primary care in rural areas. We've tested video counseling versus phone counseling for helping people quit, and also warm handoff when people are leaving our academic medical center, our hospital, for linking them with services post-discharge. So I do research, but I'm also the director of our inpatient bedside counseling service that we call You Can't Quit, and we've treated about a little over 10,000 patients through that service since we started in 2006. I've also done research on with facilities and people with a history of substance abuse, and I'm sort of getting a little bit more into the treatment of folks with a history of mental illness. So I'm just happy to share some of what I've done today, and then I'm going to bust through some of this kind of quickly, and some of it is kind of background, but I find it very helpful for both patients and providers to remember some of this stuff, and so you're very welcome to use some of these rationales, thoughts with people as you work with them in the field. And I hope we have a really lively discussion at the end of the talk, and if you want to, you know, raise your hand and write down any questions, then I'd be happy to address those at the end of the talk as well. But I probably won't stop for any raised hands on the way through. But please do remember your question, okay? So I'm going to go ahead and get started. I've got to figure out how to advance. Yay. So I'm going to talk a little bit about why so many people with mental illnesses use tobacco, and talk about a little bit about the services that are available to them, and then talk a little bit about new CMS, Centers for Medicaid and Medicare, reporting rules that are really creating a change in our academic medical center and probably are at least making waves across the country that might be helpful for folks who want to better integrate care for psychiatric inpatients. Okay, so you probably all have heard this, but really what created a big turnaround about 10 years ago, at least in the field of treatment of people with mental illness, was this report, which really found that people with serious mental illnesses die 25 years on average, younger than the general population. And it wasn't from what you would think, homelessness, suicide, that kind of thing. It was really by chronic diseases, like cardiovascular disease, stroke, COPD. And they're the same kinds of things, they're the kind of things that are caused by a lot of them by smoking. And so I think that, you know, really, if you're interested in extending the quality and the quantity of people's lives, you really need to tackle some health behaviors and especially tobacco use. And there have been a number of studies that have come out that have really looked at this, and they found that people with mental illness, even though they compose about 9% of the U.S. population, they consume almost half of the cigarettes that are smoked in the U.S. And when you really look at it, Jody Prochaska found that most smokers with a diagnosis of mental illness, or most people with mental illness actually meet criteria, DSM-4 criteria for tobacco dependence, for nicotine dependence. And we don't have that same data for DSM-5, but I've got to believe it maps pretty closely. And so if people are using tobacco who have a history of mental illness, including substance abuse, they're likely to be to have a disorder that requires pretty heavy-duty treatment. And when you look at people with a history of mental illness, And the prevalence of smoking among the different groups, I'm going to try to use this fancy pointer here. I don't know if you guys can see this. Somebody with no history of mental illness, about 1 in 5, and I'm sorry, this is derived, this graph is derived from older data, and this is when the prevalence of smoking was about 22% in the U.S. Now it's about 20 or 19%. So if you didn't have a history of mental illness, then about 1 in 5 people smoked. But along with different diagnoses, you get increased rates of tobacco use prevalence, topping out at 70% or 68% for people with substance abuse disorders, and 61% for people with bipolar disorders. So the prevalence is incredibly high, you know, 2 to 3 times what it is among people who don't have this diagnosis. All right. So what makes it so hard to quit using tobacco? And some of that is, you know, what makes it hard for anybody to quit using tobacco, not just people with a history of mental illness, but anybody, because it's hard for everybody to quit. So I'm going to do a little bit of Addiction 101, but I think it's really helpful. I hope you find it helpful. So, you know, what makes any drug addictive? It's basically the sort of direct effects of how the drug makes you feel. This is sort of nicotine in particular, but all drugs, they activate the reward pathways in your brain, and you feel good when you smoke a cigarette, or when you have a drink, or when you snort coke or whatever. That's the direct effects that make you want to use it, because it feels good, and so you use it, and then you use it again and again. But then after a while, your brain actually kind of habituates to that use, and you get more receptors. And it starts expecting you to use that drug, and then your brain starts sending you signals when you haven't used it for a while. And we call that, you know, withdrawal or craving. And that actually is negative reinforcement. It's how you feel when you're not able to use the drug, and you're feeling bad, and so your brain starts sending you these reminders to feed me, right? And you get these intense urges, cravings, and terrible symptoms that all go away as soon as you use the drug. So that is the negative reinforcement. So it's really a double-edged sword, right? It gets you by feeling, making you feel good when you use it, but it also makes you continue using it because your brain adapts to it. You get more receptors, you get prompts to use the drug, and you get withdrawal. So you get a kick in the butt when you don't use it, and it stops as soon as you use it. So that's the kind of revolving door or double-edged sword, the positive and the negative reinforcement that keeps addiction going. Now, cigarettes aren't hugely psychoactive, right? But they do have a really bad withdrawal profile, and so people feel really bad when they don't use it. So you get some positive reinforcement to keep you going, and then the negative reinforcement when you try to stop is really bad, and that causes relapse. Okay, so then also, what goes into making a drug addictive is how much of the drug reaches your brain, how fast. And then also, because if you get a really big amount in your brain, it's going to, of course, feel really good, and then create faster brain changes, and then that'll set up addiction. And then how quickly it's cleared from your brain receptors so that you're available to get that feel good again, or you start getting your withdrawal again. So how quickly it's cleared also feeds into that. And those peaks and dips in the blood levels and in your brain levels set up this merry-go-round that people go on, feel good when they use or feel bad when they don't use, that sets up addiction, is really strong in nicotine dependence, and that chronic use creates those long-term changes in the brain. So this is all sort of mounting up. Now, what makes it so hard to stop using cigarettes in particular? Okay. They are the most amazing drug delivery system ever created. You think about heroin, injected heroin, everybody thinks, well, that's really addictive, right? So you inject heroin into your vein, but then it has to go to your heart, right? It delivers back to your heart, and then it gets pumped to your lungs to get oxygenated, then it goes back to your heart, then it gets distributed to the rest of your body, including your brain, okay? But when you think about nicotine, it goes straight to your lungs, then to your heart and to your brain. So the route is much faster. And cigarettes are free-based, just like cocaine made into crack cocaine. So they're to be absorbed deep in your lungs so that when you, and if you were to spread the surface area of the deep areas of your lungs where all that oxygen exchange happens, it's the size of a tennis court. So you get a huge amount of nicotine taken up into your bloodstream super fast. And then there's even more, when you think of, and it gets pumped to your brain really fast. Now, how often does this happen? Smokers take 12 to 15 puffs per cigarette. So that's 12 to 15 puffs. Okay. And then if you multiply that out, like a pack a day smoker, will be taking 12 puffs. That's lowballing it, times 20 cigarettes a day. So times 365 days a year, that's like 87,000 puffs per year. If they puff a bit more, it's 100,000 puffs per year. Now, in our hospital, we ask people how long they've been smoking, and it's on average among the people we treat 29 years. So that's 29 times 100,000. So people are doing that little puff feel good or puff stop feeling bad, right, stop the withdrawal they were feeling because they couldn't smoke for a while. Millions of times. So, people sort of ask, like, why didn't this person stop smoking? They've got COPD, their mother died from cigarettes, blah, blah, blah. You know, but often I have to ask myself when I look at someone and their smoking history and how much they smoke, how in the world is it possible for them to smoke? You know, it's incredibly ingrained. People have been doing it for so long. It is incredibly difficult to get off of that merry-go-round for all of the reasons that I mentioned. I'm going to go back. You know, you've got to ask how anyone can stop. But if you look at the epidemiology, people, no matter what their demographic, their age, their comorbidities, anything, they manage to quit. So what we need to ask ourselves is not, you know, pity smokers or bash them for not having quit already, but just think about, you know, what is it going to take to help them quit? And we need to start thinking about tobacco dependence as a chronic, relapsing condition. It's going to take a lot of time to help them quit. And we need to give them dynamic, longitudinal care with the best tools that we have available to make every quit attempt count. Understanding that it's going to take people a number of quit attempts to be able to stop. So we need to take our gloves off and start reaching for medications, counseling, and then when things don't work, change our strategies. Now, what happens when people are able to quit? They gain on average 6 years of life regardless of their age. And you got to think about it, that maybe people with a history of mental illness or substance abuse, they might stand to gain even more years of life because on average they've smoked longer and heavier. So if they're able to quit, that, you know, quitting smoking may benefit them even more than someone who doesn't have those comorbidities. So this statement below repeats what I said before. We really need to rethink how we're treating tobacco dependence. So why do so many people with mental illnesses smoke? I'm going to just walk through this quickly. There are biological factors, barriers to tobacco treatment, systems factors, other factors. The biological factors are that, you know, if someone has started using tobacco and they're trying to stop, then they're having problems with concentration, et cetera, and it really makes it hard to get through their day. And there may be some things that created vulnerability to have a mental illness that also create a vulnerability to becoming dependent on tobacco. So there may be some underlying risks that cause both. There are a lot of barriers to tobacco treatment within the mental health system and also the medical system in general. So there are some systems factors where, you know, it's really been an ingrained part of of mental health treatment for a long time. And in the past, it was even used as a reinforcer. People could go out on smoke breaks, or it was an opportunity to get outside for people who used tobacco. And the clinician factors are pretty whopping, because a lot of people who work in substance abuse treatment and in mental health treatment are smokers themselves, and they're going to be less likely and in some instances less willing to address tobacco dependence. And then there are some things that cross across client and consumers in that, and also the providers, in that providers sometimes feel it helps them bond with their clients. And then there's been very, very specific tobacco industry targeting to fight any kind of tobacco, like clean indoor air regulations for mental health facilities, and to also promote the idea that people with schizophrenia, for example, need to smoke in order to improve their symptoms, et cetera. So there have been a lot of factors kind of piled up against providing proper treatment. And when you so here is actually a quote from someone with schizophrenia. I've been a schizophrenic since I was 14. I was told more or less when I went to the hospitals that cigarettes help control certain areas in my brain and the way we function out in society. I became more of a smoker because I was told it would help me with my illness. I was taught more about it helping my illness than I was about cancer and stuff like that. So we really need to turn that around. Okay. Now, we need to remember that quit rates among people with mental health diagnosis might be significantly lower than for those with no history. And that's true also among people with alcohol and substance use disorders. We know that they're going to be lower than folks without that history. But still, we know, and we have good data, that has found that tobacco treatment works among these people. You may not get as high a quit rate. It may not be as powerful or as effective among people with mental illness, but it does work better than not providing any treatment at all. So we really need to start providing these treatments to folk, and I'm going to be covering exactly what those treatments are. But that does feed into the fact that so many people with mental illness smoke because they may have vulnerabilities to smoking that go along with their vulnerability to mental illness. They're not getting treatment. Treatment might be, when they do get tobacco dependence treatment, it might be a little bit less effective. And so, prevalence equals the number of people who start using a substance or start having a problem times how long they use it. So because there's not a focus on tobacco treatment and people aren't quitting, and it's been a part of the psychiatric culture, and people also have poor access to primary care, so mental health providers tend to want to point people to primary care to get their help with quitting tobacco, but many people might not have access to that. And there are, in general, lower rates of quit attempts, in part because of the low access to tobacco treatment services. There's going to be higher tobacco relapse. It sort of feeds into this higher prevalence. And so one way we can tackle that is to improve our treatment and the quality of the treatment. Now, what I'm going to do is, before I launch into talking about what treatments work for people with a history of mental illness and substance abuse, I'm going to talk just a tiny bit about some research that I did that just looked at what is happening, and this is in particular in substance abuse treatment facilities, okay? So I'm just going to walk through this to talk about what is happening right now in these facilities. It was, we did a study where we did some qualitative research among 8 substance abuse treatment facilities that had all kinds of treatment approaches in Kansas City. And then we created actually a scale that measures prevalence and type of tobacco treatment services, and then we validated that, and then we administered that to 400 clinics across the U.S. to assess the prevalence of tobacco treatment in facilities across the U.S. So in the 8 facilities that we looked at, we sort of did a little checklist looking at asking them, the directors, what do they do around tobacco treatment? And about 60% said they routinely assess smoking status, and I'm looking at the bars here. And about the same amount said that they monitor progress of smoking cessation. About 30% said they referred people for tobacco treatment, and about half said that they had a written policy that required them to provide tobacco treatment, and about half said that they provide counseling for tobacco treatment. And a lot of them said that they refer people out for some kind of pharmacotherapy to help them quit using tobacco. And a number of them said they had some kind of office reminder or some kind of an office system to help remind them to actually address tobacco with their patients. But when we actually went and looked in the charts of the providers, and I'm sorry the axes aren't showing up very well on this graph, nearly everybody routinely assessed smoking status. They actually did better than they reported when we looked at their charts. But none of the charts actually, and we looked at a lot of charts of smokers in these facilities, none of them had any note as to any progress in terms of their tobacco use. None of them noted any referrals to any other providers for getting help in quitting. One of the facilities actually recorded whether a patient was interested in quitting or not. They didn't ask that routinely. The others didn't. Interested in quitting and then interested in getting treatment. And there was no recorded incidence at all of actual treatment provided. Okay? And we looked at this both longitudinally among, all the patients since the time they'd been in treatment and then in the past 30 days. So there was really no tobacco treatment being provided, at least that was being charted. So when we also did a lot of interviews, and this is kind of what we found, and we talked to staff as well as patients, as well as the directors, none of them really have a dedicated program for tobacco. They say they provide tobacco treatment, but they don't have a program for it. And I think this was from a patient. I don't know what they do, much other than lectures, occasional lectures. You know, as far as I know, that's all they do. If they're doing something else, will be good, but it's not part of their curriculum to have to do it. And this was actually from an intern. Personally, I've been an intern here since February, and I haven't seen anything about treating tobacco, just dealing with illegal drugs and alcohol. And most people say, yeah, we address it, but it's part of a health promotion session. So they have one session or one series of groups that are devoted to health, and they may address tobacco there. The staff even said, we provide information, but it's up to the patients to come and ask to stop smoking. And another person said the same thing. And they don't do anything about motivating unmotivated smokers. So they say it's not something that I pursue unless the initiative has to come from the client. But they said, we use tobacco all the time as an example. It's like, boy, people who are addicted to cocaine, they might not realize recognize their cocaine withdrawal, but man, you can tell them about tobacco and people recognize that right away. And then a number of people said, look, we address people's, their court mandate for treatment, and we address what the court sends them here for. One site actually provided on-site nicotine replacement, but again, it was the patient had to ask for it. And most people send folks to their primary care providers for any other kind of medication. But medications really, from the experience or from the perspective of the folks who we interviewed, weren't routinely used or encouraged. So what we found as we, think back across the data that we got from the chart reviews and everything else was that there's a lot of discrepancies. And just saying that you provide tobacco treatment does not necessarily mean that it happened. And that affected how we designed our survey. So we asked you, we didn't say, do you provide tobacco treatment or do you provide it routinely? We said, how among your patients that are in your program right now, about what proportion of them smoke and then about what proportion of them did you provide treatment to? So that makes them really answer in terms of who's getting treatment. So I think it helped us get a little bit better questions. This is the actual survey that we also, let me think, I'm going to back up. So I think that was it. There was just a big discrepancy in between what people said was happening and between what was actually happening. So that helped us create our survey, our index of tobacco treatment quality. And it was a 7 item scale that asked, you know, what percentage of your patients who smoke were asked, or what percentage of your patients were asked at intake if they smoke cigarettes. And then from there on, we asked, what percentage of your patients who smoked were assessed for their readiness to stop using, were advised that they should stop, got counseling, got individual or group, were recommended to use quit smoking medications. And then we asked another question about how often the treatment was provided. And then we actually summed those scores. So that came, they came up with a score of 1 to 5, or sorry, yeah, 0, yeah, 1 to 5. One being very low levels of treatment for tobacco dependence. And this is when we administered the survey to 405 facilities across the U.S. Some facilities did absolutely nothing. I don't know if you can see my arrow. And the modal, that means the most frequent response, was about 1.5, so kind of on the lower end of providing all of those services. And very few facilities said, we provide these things to most of our patients most of the time. That would be a perfect score of 5.0. We sort of calculated the responses to come up with a score of 1 to 5, 1 being not doing anything and 5 basically doing everything with most of their patients. So as you can see, substance abuse treatment facilities have a long way to go across the U.S. in terms of routinely providing tobacco treatment to their patients. Okay, and so, you know, conclusions across all of this is that, at least in substance abuse treatment facilities, I don't think a similar study has been done in mental health facilities. People aren't doing a lot, and there's a big difference between saying that you have a program and actually providing treatment. When treatment happens, it's often informal and opportunistic. It requires the patient to step up and say, I want to do something. One thing that we did find was that everybody agreed that tobacco was dependence-forming and harmful. And very few people really argued that it would knock people off of their recovery. I think that the message that quitting tobacco use can actually help you in your other substance abuse recovery has really gotten out there. There, some people may feel that, but for the most part, I think that message has gotten out there that it actually helps with substance abuse treatment. And most people report that they're doing some form of tobacco education in their general drug education or in their health groups. So this is where we found the state of the art to be, and this was a little while ago in substance abuse treatment facilities across the U.S. Now, we know, and here's some data here, that multiple studies have found that behavioral health patients are interested in quitting and they'll enroll in tobacco treatment. That tobacco treatment is effective among people with substance abuse and mental health problems. And that multiple studies have found that quitting doesn't harm and may actually help with substance abuse and with mental health outcomes. And we also, a number of people have found that there are some other, a little more broader, less measurable sort of trends in benefits from addressing tobacco dependence. There is emerging evidence that there people's comorbidities, that other illnesses are reduced. It can reduce people's financial burden. It can increase their self-confidence because they are tackling something that's going to help them live longer and better. It can reduce feelings of stigma because, unfortunately, tobacco users are stigmatized nowadays in the U.S., and it can increase the focus on mental health and wellness. So there's a lot of other payoffs to addressing it as well. And so when you adopt that wellness philosophy, I think really tobacco has to go along with that. This is a wonderful poster. I can't remember where it's from. It's in the fine print there. And the woman says, I didn't survive from depression and suicide attempts so I could die from lung cancer. I had to stop smoking. And really, you know, we need to help people keep up with their community. I think that's a big focus in community-centered mental health, and we're not doing that if we don't help people quit using tobacco. So how do we help people with mental illnesses quit? These are the sort of generic guidelines for everyone who is a tobacco user. We need to intervene and offer assistance to all smokers, regardless of readiness to quit. All of these recommendations are based on many, many, many clinical trials. And all of these things are linked directly to have been shown to help people quit using tobacco. Brief advice to quit: each time we see a smoker, has a cumulative effect on their likelihood of trying to quit and actually quitting. So brief advice is important. Asking them if they're ready to quit is now part of the guidelines. If they're not ready, and that'll be the majority of people, then we need to provide some kind of brief motivational interventions. And if they are ready to quit, then what works in helping people to quit is medications, either single medications or combination medications, and 4 or more counseling sessions. And the quit line definitely is effective and increases people's odds of quitting. And we need to develop clinic systems to make sure this all happens. It's not enough to say you do this and you don't have anything built into your systems to make sure you do it routinely. So that's sort of the general guidelines. Now, what happens if people get these medications and counseling? If someone phones the quit line, on average, about 13% of them will be quit at a year, and that is without any medications or anything. So, when you realize that only in the general population, maybe 3 to 5% of people who try to quit will actually stay quit a whole year. This is doubling or even tripling their odds of being quit at a year. With group counseling, it's maybe a little more effective. That's in-person group counseling. Individual counseling, it might go up a bit more. So you can see that the more intensive your intervention is, the bigger chaos is. So if you go all the way up to combination pharmacotherapy and counseling, then you're going to get over a third of people quit at a year. And this is for one single round of treatment, right? So if we provide longitudinal dynamic care like we do for depression, hypertension, anything else, and someone comes back in, we ask them, how is their quit attempt going? How are things working? And they say, not so great. They relapse. And we try something different. We add on a medication if they weren't on a medication, or we add on another medication if they were on one, or we step up the intensity of counseling, and they get multiple assists in a given year, then we could drive that cessation up even higher. So we really have not taken off the gloves with tobacco, and we need to provide people with these effective treatments. And when things don't work, when strategies don't work, we need to change tactics, just like we do with everything else. Okay, so what medications are there? There's nicotine replacement, several different kinds, and then non-nicotine medications, bupropion and varenicline are first line. And then there are also some other medications with good clinical trial evidence that they are effective, but they aren't actually part of the guidelines yet. Sometimes it's not advancing very quickly. Okay, there we go. Now, some medications may be especially helpful for smokers with specific conditions. So for people with depression, there have been a number of clinical trials that have found that bupropion and nortriptyline works significantly better than not getting any kind of medication or placebo. And schizophrenia, it's interesting. Bupropion, that's Wellbutrin or Zyban, it seems to be particularly effective among patients with schizophrenia, which is terrific because it's so widely available and inexpensive, and we know a lot about it. And we know that psychiatric smokers have a higher level of dependence, and so they may require higher doses of cessation medications and then combination medications. We know also with psychotropic or psychiatric medications, that when people smoke cigarettes, that some the tobacco smoke, it's not actually the nicotine, it's components of the smoke, actually can reduce the efficacy of psychotropic medications, and people who are smoking cigarettes may actually be on higher doses than are completely necessary. So when people taper down and stop smoking, we need to monitor that and perhaps adjust their medication, and this is actually another nice benefit of quitting, because, of course, if they're using less psychiatric medications, they may experience fewer of the side effects that go along with that. Okay, so people always ask, what's the best medication for me? And so basically, bupropion, which is also called Wellbutrin or Zyban, and nicotine replacement basically double your odds of quitting. So if you ever played a lottery ticket and somebody could give you something that would make it twice as likely to win, or you ever went to a casino, they said, I've got something that makes twice as likely you're going to win. Are you going to use it? You know, why not? So it doubles your odds of quitting. Chantix or varenicline is the most effective single medication. It increases your odds of quitting by 3 times. If you do combination pharmacotherapy like Wellbutrin plus any kind of nicotine replacement or patch and short-acting nicotine replacement, then you do even better than varenicline. And the choice really should be made based on the patient's contraindications, their preferences, what resources they have, and you can always start a little bit lower so that you can change tactics if one particular strategy doesn't work. So that's the nice thing, is we have tons of things in our back pockets to help people quit using tobacco. Now, in terms of behavioral interventions, Mike Steinberg and other folks at Rutgers now provided brief motivational intervention and personalized feedback, and they were actually able to motivate 1 in 3 of schizophrenics to seek cessation treatment. So it wasn't a very lengthy intervention, and it had a really big payoff in terms of getting the large number of people who aren't quite ready to tip the balance and move over into seeking treatment. And we know that for people who are wanting to quit use tobacco, who are ready to take that step, that we really need to provide longitudinal dynamic counseling. And you need to know all of these things. And you guys and the people who already work in substance abuse and mental illness field, you guys know how to do this stuff. You just need to turn your minds toward using it with tobacco. There are other great resources, the Tobacco Quit Line. Each state usually has their specific number, so if somebody calls 1-800-QUIT-NOW, they're going to get the New York Quit Line. They'll get the Kansas Quit Line if their phone is from Kansas. Then there's also Text to Quit, and, you know, this is, again, you know, think of the armamentarium that you have. If somebody's not quite ready to jump into even the quit line or any kind of in-person counseling, maybe, you know, you can start by signing them up for a text to quit, and they can try that out. And if that doesn't work, then you've got the quit line. And if that doesn't work, then you've got, you know, in-person counseling or some other stuff, maybe groups in your facility. So start thinking in terms of all the different resources you can gather to help cobble together longitudinal plans for people. There's tons of other resources. I'm not going to dwell on these. Hopefully you guys will have access to these things. There's free interactive internet support, and then there's some apps out there that are evidence-based. They may not have gone through clinical trials to see how exactly effective they are in helping people quit, but they're providing good information to people. Okay, and you need to create systems to offer help routinely. Okay, so most facilities are asking about tobacco use, but is it then appearing in their system in front of the provider when the provider goes into the room? So in some facilities, they'll ask about it, and then it goes into the dungeon of unfindable things in the electronic health record, and it doesn't hit the provider in the face when they walk in the room to talk to the person about what they're there for today. So you need to look at your systems and make sure that you get seamless handoff. And if providers need training, they report that routinely. Smoke-free facilities help a lot because people aren't having to walk through that gauntlet of smoke when they go into treatment. Okay. So here's an example of an office system. You've got it in your electronic health record to ask people routinely if they use tobacco and are ready to quit. If they're not ready, then a provider or maybe even a coach can provide a brief motivational intervention. If they're ready, you can ask them if they want to set a quit date. If not, they can still start in on treatment. You can provide individual or group counseling or refer out to the quit line or even start them on a text messaging if that's all they want to start. With pharmacotherapy, there's tons of options there. You can build their tobacco treatment goals into their treatment plan and assess them often, as often as you assess anything else, and then set a follow-up visit. You know, you don't want to cover your eyes and say, okay, I hope it worked for them. You can bring them back in because guess what? You've got tons of other things you can do with them, and you can tell them that. You've got their back. There's other things we can do if this doesn't work. And don't feel bad if it doesn't work because you've been dealing with this for a long time. Help staff who smoke to quit. Very important. It's hard for staff who are not getting benefits to see the beautiful treatment program rolled out for patients when they're struggling themselves. Have smoke-free buildings and campuses and other policies. Train staff in how to treat tobacco dependence, and you can designate a site champion to kind of keep things going. Okay, here's one great resource I haven't mentioned yet. This is a group-based program. It's got 20 sessions. It was developed by folks who were at the Robert Wood Johnson School of Medicine, and that's now moved to Rutgers. It's available for free. It's got, if you're running a group session, people can just pull out the group for that day. It's like a one-page thing. You can read it walking the group. You can lead a lively group discussion. It includes other things than just tobacco, but it really is focused on tobacco. There are many, many sessions that are just thinking about what tobacco does to you, you know, what do you like and not like about it, lots of stuff for people who are in pre-contemplation, haven't quite made the decision, and then there are dedicated sessions for people to help them quit. It's a great program, and you can just download it and try it out. Lots of people, a number of facilities in Kansas are using it now, and they really love it. Staff and the clients love it. So there's that. Now, I'm just going to talk a tiny bit more about what's happening with psychiatric units, and then we'll have time for questions. Now, hospitals that receive funding from Medicare, if they have a psychiatric unit, they have to start reporting on the number of patients who use tobacco in the inpatient psychiatric unit and the number of tobacco users who are offered quit tobacco medications or counseling in the hospital, and then the percentage who received that. And that has caused our hospital to really turn things around in terms of both assessing tobacco use and then also calling our team, our inpatient tobacco team, to actually provide treatment to these patients. So it would be, we've done a number of things with our electronic health record, et cetera, to get this going. And then we refer people to the tobacco quit line before they leave, and then also get prescriptions written for medications. And I can talk more about that if you like. So that's really exciting development that's happening. And starting in January, the bar is going to get a little bit higher. I'm clicking on the advance, and it's not wanting to advance. There we go. So treatment is ethical. You know, we really must do no harm, but without assistance, people are going to continue to smoke, and they're going to be dying from it. And the idea is to offer, not mandate, tobacco treatment, keep it on the problem list, and motivate every few months, and let the smoker decide the timing. But don't, you know, I covered a ton of stuff. And I hope you got the message that we just need to think of this in terms of longitudinal dynamic care. I love this quote. Those who deliver mental health care often pride themselves on treating the whole patient, on seeing the big picture, and not being bound by financial irrationality or by the biases of their culture. Yet many fail to treat nicotine dependence. They forget that when their patient dies of a smoking-related disease, their patient has died of a psychiatric illness that they failed to treat. So I'm going to stop there. We've got hopefully about 10 minutes for questions and stuff. and discussion.
Thank you so much, Kim. This is Pat Bax. I'm the Marketing and Outreach Coordinator here at the New York State Smokers Quit Line at Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo. And I want to thank you for your excellent and motivating presentation. We'll take questions in just a moment, but I wanted to welcome our new and returning participants on our call today. We do look forward for you to participate in future calls. Our next call will be February 3rd, 2016. If you are unfamiliar with the New York State Smokers Quit Line, as I mentioned, we're operated by Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo, and we do provide a free, confidential, and evidence-based cessation service for all New York State residents. Kim mentioned in her presentation the importance of the Quit Line as a resource and really a cessation hub for all New York State residents. Tobacco users can call the Quit Line directly. They can register for nicotine replacement therapy in the form of patches. They can go online and register as well, and they can be referred through a provider. We do offer free motivational coaching, patches, motivational support, extensive resources that you can find on our website, in our online smoke-free community, social media, and our messaging. I encourage you to explore all our resources at nysmokefree.com for helpful, ready-to-use tools, such as our referral program, including our systematic, policy-driven, opt-to-quit referral program, and our free downloadable materials. And I also want to mention that we have our annual report for 2014 posted under our provider section link, and it highlights our services and data. And if you're interested to learn more about our referral process, you can actually call us directly at 1-866-697-8487. And the countdown continues for the Great American Smokeout. Many of you use this particular cessation holiday as an opportunity to work with your patients and your clients on their cessation efforts. This year it takes place on November 19th. And the Quit Line is available to help you with materials and resources, tips, and suggestions. So please contact us again at 1-866-NY-QUITS. That's 1-866-697-8487 for help. Thank you again for your participation today and for all your assistance in helping your tobacco-using patients and clients to become and stay tobacco-free. And at this time, Laura, we will open it up for questions.
Certainly. The floor is now open for questions. If you do have a question, please press the number 7 or the letter Q on your telephone keypad. Questions will be taken in the order they were received. And if at any point your question has been answered, you may press 7 or Q again to disable your request. Please hold while we wait for the first question.
We do have a couple questions in the chat room. We have a question from Loris, we get people who complain about not getting enough free nicotine patches, and they disregard our encouragement to take advantage of the Quit Line. I think to respond to that question, I just want to mention, keep in mind that the patches or any nicotine replacement therapy really addresses the physical aspect of the addiction. And it's really important to remember that even if someone may not qualify for patches for whatever reason, a medical reason might be, we can certainly provide them with coaching, motivational coaching. In addition, we are a population-based service, so we try to reach as many people as possible. And we do ask all our participants who call us what type of health plan that they have. And we try to provide them either with direct triage to their health plan for additional nicotine replacement therapy and coaching, or we at least give them the phone number, or if we have a script from the health plan, we can provide them with that information. So as a cessation hub, we try to link people with all the resources available to them in New York State to be successful in quitting. We have another question here about the PowerPoint. It is posted in several different versions. It's posted as a PDF and also as a black and white copied handout that you can use for printing if you would prefer to print it. And it can be found on our website, nysmokefree.com, under Health Providers and Partners, and under Collaborative Call, and you will be able to find those resources there.
I Again, if you do have a question on the telephone line, you may press 7 or the letter Q. Our first question comes from Svetlana Nosova. Svetlana, please go ahead.
Actually, can you repeat the quit line phone number, please?
Yes, the number is 1-866-697-8487.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. We do have a question in the chat room from Nola Goodrich. How do you address when participants of a drop-in center sale to be coming in if there is a nicotine-free campus? And Nola, I don't know if you'd like to expand on your question.
So if you have people coming in and they're smoking, how do you you know, it's hard. We deal with this on our hospital campus a lot. And, you know, it's tough, but in generally I walk up and say, I'm sorry, but we're a smoke-free campus, you're not able to smoke here. You could cross the street here and smoke over there. For a while, when we went smoke-free, we were offering, we had cards that had the tobacco quit line number on it, and for patients and employees, we actually had a brief employee smoking cessation program, so you can use it as an opportunity to let them know about cessation resources. You know, if you're at all interested, then, you know, we can do this, this, and this. Most people are really okay with it. Some people get cranky, but most people, you know, they'll just move on. Or apologize and crush the cigarette.
Again, if you do have a question, you may press the number 7 or the letter Q on your telephone keypad. Our next question comes from Sarah Pearl. Sarah, please go ahead.
Hi, thanks so much. That was a great presentation. We really appreciate it. I actually had two questions. You mentioned that there was emerging evidence that smoking cessation aided in substance abuse recovery.
Mm-hmm.
I'm aware of one study, and I'm wondering if you might be able to elaborate on other studies.
Yeah, there are multiple studies. Some of them have sort of looked like – I'm sorry, did you want to ask your second question?
No, I can ask it after.
Okay. There are multiple studies that have sort of looked at people sort of longitudinally and looked at people who did quit and didn't quit, and the people who do quit do better. Then there was one really great group trial that looked at it was a cluster randomized trial, so they were providing tobacco treatment in some facilities and not in others. And the people in the facilities that got the tobacco dependence treatment, they didn't tend to quit smoking more. It wasn't so effective for that. But their drug use outcomes, their alcohol use outcomes were better. And that's an even stronger study because it was a randomized trial. Because you'd think, well, you know, if people tend to quit smoking, maybe they're just, you know, better able to handle their substance addiction, you know, addiction as well. But there was that clinical trial. I can't remember the author, but there are a couple of reviews that summarize that information as well. And I'm not quite sure how to get that to you, but I can send an email to the folks who organized it. You know,
sure, absolutely. I'm happy to pull down. Your email was at the front slide. I'm happy to reach out to get that if that's okay.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah, just send me an email.
Terrific. So my second question was, you know, most of the evidence you presented came from the clinical guidelines from Fiore, which is essentially for the general population.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, our experience here in New York is that, and I think this is the experience nationally, is that, you know, essentially comprehensive tobacco control has been enormously effective for the general population. Within the mental health community and within the substance abuse community, It has not. We have not seen any declines. We've seen a 35% decline in the general population since 2002. That's just not the case with our substance abuse population and our, you know, mental health population.
So, right. You know, and I think a lot of it is
No, the thing that I was curious about was that, you know, you had one slide where you were talking about specific medications that were better or, you know, that were more effective for specific illnesses, and it looked to me like that slide was not a Fiori-based slide.
Right, right. I mean, everything is based on the clinical guidelines, and right now the guidelines are pretty silent as to what might work best among people with substance abuse or mental illness. So I picked out specific studies that did speak to that, and there are some of that is pulled from reviews, and some of it was from specific studies. And I think the reason that we haven't seen a decline in prevalence is number one, it's number one that treatment is not being offered in any kind of healthcare setting that people go to, and a lot of people don't have access to primary care. So we don't even know that sort of the general population treatments, how effective they are, because people aren't getting them. But on the also, there have been some studies done specifically among these populations, and then I tried to describe what specific things they were doing. And the one beautiful example that could be very powerful is Mike Steinberg's intervention with unmotivated smokers, schizophrenics, because that's going to be a large proportion of the population, that, you know, unmotivated, people who are not motivated to quit. And that's true in the general population, too, and it was super effective. So.
No, that's very, I appreciate that. And if you don't mind, I'll reach out to you about those specific studies and reviews also. I mean, we'd be interested in knowing, you know, where you're pulling that information from. I mean, you know, the other thing you said that, you know, the issue about them having access to healthcare providers, primary care providers, is this access one, access three issue. It seems to be a hot potato, right? So, you know, the addiction counselors don't seem to think that smoking is a sufficiently critical enough addiction that it falls within the treatment plan, and the primary care providers seem to defer to the psychiatrists and the, you know, addiction and mental health providers.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't feel like anybody wants to take responsibility for treating tobacco.
Yes. The tobacco dependence is access one.
Yep.
So, and, you know, yeah, they're, everybody's pointing finger everywhere else. So, you know, we need to stop that. And it would be really great if people could get reimbursed for treating tobacco dependence as a primary diagnosis. I think that's not possible right now for psychiatrists themselves. Then that would help, I think, too. Right now, SAMHSA does not permit that. Or is it? Yeah.
So, in other words, it's only being, I mean, we know this from Medicaid, too, that essentially if you provide tobacco services as part of counseling for addiction treatment, you can increase the pay level by doing a, you know, higher level of service. But you can't bill, you're going to bill it as an individual service.
Yes. But, and this is where I don't understand very much, but Jill Williams said that as a psychiatrist, she cannot treat primary tobacco dependence. She has to treat people for other illnesses. And so for some reason, for psychiatrists, they can't, I don't know, somebody else might know this better, but there are definitely systemic problems in getting reimbursed for tobacco treatment for this population.
So that's worth addressing.
Yes, it is. And she said, you know, really just if someone could change this with a stroke of a pen, whoever is at substance abuse and mental health services, I'm not sure who it is right now, could change that. But there's a lot of backflow from people who say they don't want any resources diverted at all from treating other mental health issues. But I think it would be a great thing for some group to take on.
Terrific. Thank you so much. And I will definitely reach out to you.
Yeah. Great.
I think based on our time, I think at this point, we're going to turn it back to Beth Giroux for some closing comments. And again, I want to thank everyone for participating today. Beth?
Thanks, Pat.
On behalf of the Health Systems for Tobacco Free New York, I'd like to thank everyone for participating on our webinar today, and especially Dr. Kim Roche. Thank you for providing this informative presentation. Everyone, to receive credit for this call today, please go to the website for nysmokefree.com, and we have posted the evaluation, and it must be completed and filled out by October 31st. Our next collaborative conference call, which Pat mentioned, will be held noon on February 3rd, 2016. So please stay tuned for any further information on the next webinar, and thanks again for supporting our vision for Tobacco-Free New York. Have a good day.